You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How's everyone doing?
Good,
not
man.
Not too bad.
Good.
No complaints today.
I think I'm
today.
starting to get over, you know, the debilitating year of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Because summer's happening, and I definitely feel happiness in my veins, you know?
So there's a lot of talk about, like, what did you do during the pandemic? You know, what was your project that you did? In fact, that's going to be a segment at Nexus. We're going to have people are sending us in videos of what their pandemic project was. There's still time. You could send in your video if you did something cool.
Yeah, you could just go to nexus.org/pandemic project.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. But you know what Bob, Jay, and I did during the second half of the pandemic?
No, what did we do?
Invented new type of battery that lasts forever.
We are writing the SGU's next book.
Oh my God. Yes.
The next book.
I love you guys, and I'm so glad that I am not writing the next book. Okay. I am busy.
It takes a lot of time, but
it's a lot of time.
What a sense
it's
of
actually,
accomplishment.
It's 70% done. It'll be done by this summer. Coming out at the beginning of 2023. And you know what the book is about? I know you guys know.
Yes, I do.
I hope so. The book is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Future. It's all about the future. What does the future hold? How will technology shape our future? What's going to happen? What's not going to happen? And it's a lot of fun to write. It really is a lot of fun to write this book. It's a ton of work, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, don't forget, we also talk about how we got here. Like, you know, we pick a technology and we say, well, here's where it started. Here's where people first thought about it. Here's what, like, science fiction people thought about it. And here's how it manifested. And here we are today, how it arced out into the future.
Yeah, then maybe we can extrapolate a little bit into the future. So we'll keep you updated on that as we move along. But yeah, we should be done with the writing by the end of the summer. And then, you know, the publisher's a little bit behind schedule because of the pandemic for some reason. So they're telling us if we get it into them by the end of the summer, that we should be able to release it by the beginning of the first quarter of 2023. But, you know, we'll probably...
Steve, are you aware?
Yeah.
Steve, of our, you know, in our Patreon, we have a goal in our Patreon. It's at 6,000 patrons, and it says, imagine SGU, the television show. I know, right? The SGU wants to produce a pilot for a skeptically themed TV show. We've been talking about what that TV show should actually be because, you know, first off, in order to have a TV show, and if you're going to, like, say, I'm going to do a pilot, and you want to shop that pilot around, you have to shoot it yourself, you know, 99% of the time. Like, it's very difficult to get, you know, to go to a company and have them pay for things like that because there's a million pilots always being shopped around. But we talked about it a lot. Like, what should the TV show actually be? Because when you say, what is the Skeptic's Guide TV show, what would that actually be? And one of the ideas we came up with was kind of like The Skeptic's Guide to the Future, which would be us discussing these technologies,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we would love to do a strictly skeptically based show, and we would absolutely want that to come into being. I just don't think the world literally is ready for a skeptically themed TV show.
Well, like, we don't know that, Jay. I think so. We're not determining at this point in time what that show would be. We have several, I think, solid ideas, but I do think The Skeptic's Guide to the Future might be the easiest one to shop around. I think it might be more popular than something that's more, you know, strictly skeptical. But we're open for ideas. But the thing is, at 6,000 patrons, we'll do it. We will do something at that point in time. And there's two levels, though, Jay, right? So one is making a sizzle reel, which we'll almost definitely do ourselves. And then there's, from the sizzle reel, then you do a pilot, which either a network can do or we could do. And then, of course, you go to an actual show.
I think that the my two cents on this is that we connect with a production company from the get-go. They have a lot more insight into what the media landscape is. Obviously, they get the information from each network. Yeah, for what they're actually looking for on any given season. And, you know, they'll help guide us and shape us, and we'll put together whatever packages are necessary depending on the network, because it's so specific. Some networks just want to see a sizzle. Mm-hmm. Some networks just want to see something on paper. Some want to fund a pilot themselves. Sometimes they go straight to series order. So we start, we start with the production company early on that we know could make the show. And and that helps us come in with a lot more power into the room.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing we want is the ability to fund whatever is part of that we need to fund.
Anything
ourselves.
We might need. Yeah, yeah, if we do, if we do need extra funding, that's for sure.
And
at
6,000 patrons, we would be making enough money at that point to do that. Kara, but before we get to 6,000 patrons, we have to get to 5,500 patrons. And at 5,500 patrons, you and I have to do a 24-hour show.
Why do you keep doing this to me?
Show.
I know.
24 hours straight.
Whose idea was this?
No, you're out of your mind, Evan. We're not doing that. It's going to be two 12-hour shows back to back, like day one, day two. There's no way that I can do 24 hours anymore.
I'm not in college anymore. When's the last time you guys pulled an all-nighter?
I don't.
Well, it's been a while, but Evan and I could do it, right,
That's
Evan?
That's right, Bob. You and I are the warriors.
Backing up one step further, at 5,000 patrons, so you know I started that Skeptical Console video series.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I did it. That was one of my other, you know, pandemic projects. I did a few of those, but that will become a regular series when we hit 5,000 patrons. And right now we're hovering around 4,600. Mm-hmm. To between 4,600 and 4,700. So we're getting close to that. So at 5,000, mm-hmm. That'll become official. At 5,500, we do the 24-hour show. And at 6,000, we are full court press for a skeptically-themed TV pilot.
Let's get
Tell your friends.
Let's get there.
If we got on a channel like Netflix or Amazon or whatever, and they really wanted to do a skeptic TV show, like really, really want to do it full, you know, dive in, you know, head first with the project like that. Wouldn't that be freaking amazing?
Of course. I would think those people out there really do exist. We just got to find them.
Ah, Jay, you sound like me talking about little nanobots going through our bloodstream.
Right, Bob? I mean, look, I can't help but fantasize about how impactful something like that could be. I mean, not only would it be fun to do, but I mean, it really would have reach at that point.
I'm so jaded.
I love how you're like so randomly jaded. I feel like my favorite game would be like, guess what Bob is optimistic about and guess what Bob is cynical about? You almost can never tell.
Well, we went through this. We got to the
that was 10 years ago, Bob.
Because
that was
we
before
did this.
You had somebody who works in television on the show.
We had a guy. We had a damn pilot. We had two episodes. We had a scissor room. We had it all. We were thinking. In my memory, it's two. We were ready to go. We were at the 11th hour, and like it's going to be on TV in a month. And then all of a sudden, nope, it's not. Goodbye.
Yeah, but that's the way it works. Yeah, there's no guarantee.
Yes, that's the way it works.
But here's the thing is though, guys, if we're at the point where we wrote a show, we have the show, we've filmed the pilot, it's great, we have some funding, we just make it for YouTube. You know what I mean? Like at this point,
that's true. Mm-hmm. There's a totally different way to go about it.
Yeah, we'll just self-produce it for social media. Like we're not as dependent on some big studio. It'd be nice for it to be on Netflix or whatever. But if, you know, we don't have to abandon it at that point. That's what I'm saying. At 6,000 patrons, we're going to do it. It's going to happen. It's just a matter of, you know, the details to be determined, you know, as per opportunity. But there's no reason why we can't do it. We got a studio, you know.
We'll never get to 6,000 patrons. What are we talking about?
You can't say that.
We will.
You can't, Bob. You know what, Bob?
There's only one way to prove that
to me. It's people like you, Bob, that hold reality back. You got to be...
Bob's trying to do some quote reverse psychology.
I know. What are you trying to do? Bob's trying to motivate us.
Yeah.
So if you want to help support the SGU and support our message and what we do and what we've been working on for 16 years, go to patreon.com/skeptics guide. Take a look. There's a lot of stuff on there. We have an incredible group of patrons right now. Our Discord is a very fun place to be. A lot of the people that see our Friday live stream are patrons, and we have a real community. I mean, a real group of people that know each other and care about each other, and the jokes are flying, and it's just a real family.
Yeah, we could say at the $5 a month level, which is like the base level, you get access to the audio version of the Friday live streams. That's another hour and a half of content almost every week. And you also get access to the SGU Discord server. And at the premium $8 level, you get access to all of our premium content. There's now over 130 extra episodes, not full episodes, but they're like interviews and new bits and uncut interviews and all that stuff on there, and more added all the time. So we try to give you as much as we can, you know, for your support. But it's also about just making sure we could get as much skeptical content out there as possible. All right, Kara, you haven't done a What's the Word in a little bit. So give us a word.
It's been so long, you forgot what it's called.
Yeah. what's this What's the Word thing?
What is the word? The word this week is operculum. And when I looked up how to say it, Internet Lady said operculum, which I think is gross and weird, so I'm not going to say it that way. operculum, also opercula or operculums. So operculum is a really cool word. I just want to say it like 900 times until it loses all meaning. But you don't even know what it means yet, Steve, you might.
I do. It's anatomical structure.
Well, and it's probably going to make sense.
To do with fish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does have to do with fish.
Their eyes or their gills? Which one?
Gills.
Okay.
Good. But not only having to do with fish. So I think the way that we should attack this is to go a little bit backward from how I usually would. Steve, I think you're thinking of the operculum, which covers the insula.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's anything that covers an opening could be an operculum, right?
Yeah. So let's look at the Latin. So the Latin word operculum comes from the Latin roots culum and operio. And when we look at culum, that's just a suffix that some nouns that were derived from verbs use. So really, I think the main thing here is the operio. And if we look at the original Latin, it would be I shut, I close, I hide, I conceal, I overwhelm, I atone for, I cover, I envelop. And so, yes, when we look at the word operculum in its current meaning from about 1713, we know that it refers to a lid or a cover or a flap, but specifically within organic structures. So, you know, Merriam-Webster says it's a body process or part that suggests a lid. They specifically point to the two most, I think, common instances of the operculum, which is the covering of the gills of a fish, or a horny or shelly plate on the posterior dorsal surface of the foot in many gastropod mollusks. So this is the thing that closes the shell when an animal retracts into its shell like a snail. Yeah, that's called the operculum. But of course, because it really is just like a lid or a cover, you see it across all sorts of different scientific, but specifically mostly biology fields. So in the brain, that is the part, the operculum, if you usually hear that term, is mostly going to be referring to the sort of covering of the insula. You're also going to hear it in dentistry. I didn't know this. It's the little flap of tissue when your molar erupts. And I still have one where one of my wisdom, because all my wisdom teeth are all the way out.
Yep.
Yeah, but I still have a little flap on the bottom left wisdom tooth. So that's my operculum. Also, we talked about anywhere within an animal, birds, there's a structure that covers like their nares, their sort of nostrils. We talked about the fish. It's this flap that covers the gills, but specifically within bony fish and the sort of trap door with gastropods. And they actually call that the aperture of the snail. It covers that. And in elasmobranchs, so like skates and sharks and rays, the operculum papillare is the iris, so that covers the eyes. And yeah, we even see it across plant biology as well, just various lids and flaps within plants, within fungi, within algae, and different organisms there. So it directly links back to the Latin translation, and pretty much anywhere where you would see some sort of a lid, you might see an operculum.
Cool.
Yeah. Now go forth and use it in a poem.
Yes. That would be a raunchy poem, I would imagine. But again, I have a filthy mind. All right.
We could be talking about the operculum to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Steve.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You could be. there are other possibilities.
Yes, there are.
It's
other
true.
Places.
And actually, one of the definitions refers to the cervical mucus plug, which fills and seals the cervical canal during pregnancy. So mm-hmm. it actually. We've all heard of the mucus, like the mucus plug within pregnancy. That's actually also referred to the as the operculum. So, yeah.
All right. Let's get to some news items. Bob, you're going to tell us about an update on the science of regeneration.
Yeah, regeneration in the news this past week. Scientists have recently gained new insights into why a salamander regenerates a lost limb and a human just forms scar tissue. So does this have the potential, you know, to lead to crazy sci-fi regeneration for people a la Wolverine? Let's see. So this is from a team led by James Godwin, PhD. Probably not good that he has God in his name in this context. He's from the MDI Biological Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine. Liz, isn't that cool? So their paper on this research, distinct TLR signaling in the salamander response to tissue damage. This was recently published in the journal Developmental Dynamics. So, all right, so let's talk about mammal regeneration. Mammals actually have more regenerative abilities than you might. Be aware, actually. So for example, all mammal embryos, in fact, all vertebrate embryos can regenerate lost limb buds, and humans can regenerate them from weeks 3 to 8 without scarring. And then after week 9, apparently, then you can still regenerate, but to a certain extent, but there will be scars. But that's not terribly impressive, right? Because it makes sense, because we're building and growing our whole body, you know, at this embryonic stage anyway. So it's like, oh, you know, big deal, because you're growing everything. The fact that you can grow it again during that time isn't that impressive. But I was thinking about that. Can we leverage that into humans regenerating by, this fact that embryos can? So I looked into that a little bit, and it says Mexican salamanders can grow back a leg. But they said that this was that because they're stuck in an embryonic state. And I'm not sure what that means, but I don't think it would be a good thing for a human to be stuck in an embryonic state. That probably wouldn't be very pretty. So I don't think that's going to be a possibility. But okay, so let's keep going. Regeneration in humans. Infants can regenerate heart tissue. There's been examples, and there's not a lot, but there have been examples of babies regenerating and repairing heart muscle. But we don't know what that regeneration window is. So, you know, how brief of a time is there when a newborn basically can do extensive repair, like to heart muscle, like after, you know, like an infant heart attack, because it does happen. It's rare, but it does happen. So there's that sort of regeneration. And then children, this one I bet all of you have heard of. Children can regenerate fingertips. And that's happened a lot. There's lots of incidents where that's been documented. But the things that you might not know about it is that it has to, when the piece of your finger that's lost, there needs to be a little bit of the nail left. If it's amputated beyond the nail bed, then chances are very, very slim. But if there's a little bit of your nail left for some reason, children can have fully regenerated nail, skin, bone, everything is totally grows back. But there's no fingerprints apparently, and it may look a little bit weird, but everything grows back fine. So that's about it for dramatic but natural human regeneration. Not that great. I mean, it's something. But we've all heard of what? What kind of regeneration have we all heard about? Lizards or tails and salamanders and stuff, frogs. But what animal is the king or queen of regeneration, do you think?
The jelly?
Star?
It's not that mole, is it? That hairless mole?
No, and that's not. Those aren't bad guesses. The one that I came across, though, was a salamander. It's a type of salamander called an axolotl.
They're so cool. They're beautiful.
So they are Mexican salamanders, and they're all but extinct in the wild. Like, what? All but extinct. So
with your regenerative
hopefully
powers.
They've got okay. thriving, you know, zoos or communities for them that are not in the wild. And they can regenerate almost anything that falls off. Brain, heart, lungs, jaws, brain. Limbs, ovaries, spinal cord, and of course, skin and tail. But brain and lungs, that's intense. That's some intense regeneration going on there. Definitely the king or queen of regeneration. Now, this latest research on this, though, Godwin compared axolotls and mice. But specifically, he compared the macrophages between them. How, you know, their specific macrophages that they use. Now, a macrophage, that's Greek for large eaters, or you could just call it J. you know, kind of like they go back and forth. It's a type of white blood cell. It engulfs and devours anything that doesn't have a surface protein that tells you that it's a healthy cell. So it's quite convenient. Yes, I'm healthy. I'm healthy. So it just eats it all up. So what Godwin and his team were doing was they're doing a comparison because, like a lot of good science, it's building on previous discoveries. And I think they actually made the previous discoveries that showed that if the macrophages were absent, then regeneration did not happen. So when trying to find out what's going on more specifically about regeneration, of course, you're gonna focus on the macrophages because it's something clearly is very critical about those macrophages in terms of regeneration. So if the axolotl or mice had bacteria or viruses to deal with, right? So if they had an infection, just a classic fungal, viral, or bacterial infection, then the J macrophages, they all behave the same way. Right. They essentially promoted inflammation to help what's going on. But however, where the asymmetry comes in, if there was an injury, not an infection, but if there was an injury, then the macrophages in the mice promoted scar tissue while the macrophages in the axolotl produced or promoted new tissue growth. That's where it diverged. If it's an infection, then it's basically starts some inflammatory process. But if it's an injury, the salamander promoted new tissue growth, and the mouse just said, oh, I'm just going to throw some scar tissue in there and be done with it. So that's a different. So now if you want to go one or two onion layers down below that, so what's happening is that there's a macrophage protein called toll-like receptors, T-O-L-L. So these receptors are behaving differently for some reason for the axolotls. That's the crux of it. So normally, like I said, the protein induces some kind of inflammation for an infection or an injury. But in this case, it's an injury. They're doing something different that other animals do not do. So this is that's the crux of the new window into regeneration that this research has opened up. So of course I'm thinking, all right, so what does this mean for the future? So I'll give you a Godwin quote here. He said, our research shows that humans have untapped potential for regeneration. And that's the line you see on so many of the articles talking about this, that humans have untapped potential for regeneration. And he continues, if we can solve the problem of scar formation, we may be able to unlock our latent regenerative potential. Axolotls don't scar, which is what allows regeneration to take place. But once a scar has formed, it's game over in terms of regeneration. If we could prevent scarring in humans, we could enhance quality of life for so many people. Now, of course, with our luck, regrowing limbs or hearts or lungs probably won't be possible because that would just be too cool and awesome. But even if we just are able to eventually do away with scarring, just scarring, that would be a game changer for diseases, for those diseases where scarring is hugely debilitating, like a heart disease, lung disease, two huge ones where scarring happens and it's really, really bad. So if you can get rid of the scarring just in those two situations alone, I mean, there's also, I think, liver disease scars horribly as well. That would be a huge, huge plus.
But scarring is also really beneficial.
Right. So that's where Godwin's next quote comes in. He says, I envision being able to use a topical hydrogel at the site of a wound that is laced with a modulator that changes the behavior of human macrophages to be more like those of the axolotl. So it would be specific. It's not like I'm going to turn you into this non-scarring entity and you're going to be able to regenerate everything. So he's looking at it this way of having it be specifically applied. And that's more short term. Who knows what his long term thoughts are. And I don't think it would ever be as simple as that, but imagine if it were that simple where, you lose a finger because Sam the Vampire added it to his collection. And I apologize because I've been watching Van Helsing on Netflix and I recommend it. It is gruesomely awesome. So all right, you lose a finger and all you do is you turn off the scarring. And, you get to it fast, you turn off the scarring, and you just regrow the damn thing. I mean, there's no way it's going to be that easy. I'm sure there's going to be maybe 100 different other things you would need to do to really to make that work, assuming that we can even tap into this, this regenerative possibilities that we have in our genome. Because apparently we've got some, we've got some ability to regenerate in insignificant ways. If you got people regrowing fingers at a very, very young age, then that makes me think that there's something in our is still in there from when humanity was much more primitive and probably more lizard-like. and when we were last able to regenerate, because we were able to regenerate at some point a long, long time ago. So is it still in there? Is the code still in there? Can we tap into that? Who knows? I don't know if we'll ever get that far, but it's a fascinating step. And with this new insight, who knows where it's going to lead?
Bob, are you familiar with the Dune series?
Yes.
So you know where the term the axolotl comes up in the Dune series?
Yes, that's what I was
axolotl tickling. Tanks, the Bene Tarraxu. Yes. That's what the regeneration tanks.
Oh, my
tanks.
God. Good get, man, because I knew that name that was so familiar, and I didn't make the connection to Dune. Excellent. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, it's always hard to know where like this basic science will
right.
lead.
Baby steps, incremental
but
steps.
There's also
this is a nice incremental
you know,
step.
There are the one thing I don't think you mentioned is like your nerves will regenerate. Nerves will completely regenerate. Peripheral nerves.
But peripheral nerves.
Yes, not central nerves. But and right. there's actually researchers that I know at Yale that are working on trying to figure out the difference. Why do nerves regenerate and not your spinal cord? And there are other genes that they've identified, like the so-called go-no-go genes that they talk about, where they determine whether or not the nervous tissue will regenerate or not. The idea is we just need to figure out how to flip on the correct genes to make everything regenerate.
Yeah.
But there's, I think there's, the other thing to mention is there's a reason why we don't have infinite regeneration. Why would we evolve not to just regenerate everything? And it's probably because yeah. there's a balance between the ability to regenerate and the risk of cancer. Yeah.
Yeah. Damn cancer rearing its head again. Yeah. Yep.
Right. Same thing with like number of amount of stem cells you have in your body. Right. So evolution sort of strikes this balance for individual species so that you're minimizing your risk of cancer while still maintaining sufficient healing and regeneration, but it's not unlimited. So we got to tread carefully. That's like that's the limit we're running up with some applications of stem cell therapy is that, yeah, it causes cancer. There's a reason why we're not flush with stem cells already because it's a cancer risk.
Yeah.
It's tricky, tricky science.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
We'll just have to build axolotl tanks. I'll take care of it.
No problem.
Kara, tell us about the effects of social media on memory.
Right. So there's an interesting study that was published a couple of months ago in Social Media and Society. And it's actually a study that was undertaken by some sociologists. So it's a qualitative investigation. It's not going to satisfy most of your curiosity. It's not going to answer some of the questions that I know you're going to have. But hopefully it's an entree into, I think, maybe like piquing the curiosities of different researchers who may want to look at this from a more kind of neuroscientific perspective. So the researchers basically found that likes on social media actually change the way that we feel about our memories. So basically, they started with one group of individuals who use a program called TimeHop. Have any of you guys ever used TimeHop? So TimeHop pulls from across social media platforms. So it looks at like your Facebook, it looks at your photos in your phone, it looks at Twitter, it looks at probably now Instagram, I don't know. And it tells you what was going on any particular day. And there is a feature to TimeHop that is all about streaks. And so they sort of gamify the software program. And I think all of us kind of know what happens once you start to gamify is that people start to feel competitive and they decide, oh, I don't want to miss a day because I don't want to break my streak. Yeah. So the first thing they did is they looked at individuals who already used TimeHop and who were, you know, wanting to take part in this study. And they just asked them a lot of questions and they started to develop some rich qualitative data about their experience with TimeHop. Then after that, they did a few focus groups where they took people from kind of across the spectrum and asked them a lot of pointed questions about their experience with memories and social media. So this was a wide range of people, some of whom used, you know, specific memory portions of social media. Like I think it's called memories in Facebook. You guys have all seen this, right? Like on this day, you did X, Y, and Z. So some people use that regularly. Some people had never even looked at it before. And they asked them a bunch of questions about their experience. And I have to say the results didn't surprise me. In many ways, they just reinforced what many of us already probably were thinking if we thought deeply about this at all. Turns out that these metrics like likes can negatively impact how people feel about memories, especially if somebody shares a memory and they don't get a lot of likes. So you share a memory, you don't get a lot of likes, you might start thinking more negatively about that memory.
Wondering why more people didn't like this particular post
you may not even be thinking that deeply about it. It may just be the basic feedback that you're getting. Oh, people didn't like it. Maybe it wasn't that interesting. Maybe it wasn't that wonderful. Maybe the way I'm remembering it wasn't, you know, reflective of reality.
Right.
So as we know, there are levels to memory, right? First, we encode that memory, but then later we retrieve that memory. And every time we retrieve a memory, we're actually re-encoding. Like the memories, we know that memories shift and change throughout our lives based on our retrieval process.
Yeah, you resave it after you think about it.
Yeah. And so if we now are adding this extra layer of quantification, or as they call it over and over in the study, and it's so hard for me to say, metrification.
Metrification.
So basically, yeah, or metricization. That's how they say it, metricization. Yeah. Basically, we're looking at social media metrics. What they actually developed a new term for what this feature that they're talking about is. They call it quantified nostalgia.
Whoa.
Yeah. So really think about that, right? The affective experience of the memory, the emotional experience of the memory, the way you felt about the memory or feel currently about the memory is impacted by how other people respond to the memory. And I think that this is something that has probably always happened throughout time, but it's happening now on steroids because it's happening now in a way where you can share visual data from your memory. You're not just telling somebody about your experience, you're showing them aspects of your experience, and then you're leaving it open to random people on the internet either going, good for you, thumbs up, or womp womp, thumbs down. People seem to be taking, based on the feedback, the qualitative, again, feedback from the individuals in this study, there are a lot of really interesting outcomes. So, for example, Jane, I think sometimes if you do share something, not necessarily memories, but anything on social media, you find yourself almost in spite of yourself caring about the likes number. So I think I purposely wouldn't do that if it's something that I maybe cherished. Researcher, do you think it would change it? Change how you remember the thing? The fact that you care about those numbers or likes or whatever? Jane, yeah, it might somewhat. Eva, I think in some situations it would. Like if it's a picture of a social situation, you know, like a party and it gets no likes, you're like, oh, well, that sucked. If it's just a picture of you and your friend doing some dumb thing and it gets no likes, you're like, whatever. There's a huge culture around, you know, you have to get the most likes or else you're not cool. So I think in a way that it can tarnish the memory. But at the same time, I also think it does depend on the situation. And what they found is that in individuals that specifically use time hop and specifically are sort of, you know, falling into that gamification of needing to look at streaks, there were some pretty interesting outcomes there. One of the things is this push and pull that they feel between experiencing the streak, logging into time hop, looking at what happened on that particular day, but also feeling like I don't want to do that if that memory was negative or if it's traumatizing for me. So here is participant Diana who said, quote, I think it's more just okay. I know what just happened. I'll deal with this emotionally at the time and place of my choosing. It's not today, but I also want that streak number. So I know what I have to do to get over it, to get to the end of this. I don't know. It's very kind of, there's something kind of survivalist about it. Not now, go away, delaying you for another year. I know that I won't have to think about this for a year once the notification goes away. So there's also this really interesting component of almost like forced algorithmic memory that some people might have actually said, okay, that thing that happened, I don't want to access it, but my app is telling me I should. And I'm feeling a programmatic push to relive it or at least to access this memory because the algorithm is telling me, hey, don't forget you did this thing. So, I mean, it's obviously a very complicated experience, and I would be fascinated to see further studies where individuals are actually have memories, put them out there on social media. And then there's like an experimental group, right, where some people get negative reactions, some people get positive reactions, and then they're given some sort of survey later that asks them to answer valued statements about their memory, not knowing that it has anything to do with the likes or the lack of likes. I think that would be a really cool way to kind of quantify what these researchers did qualitatively. But regardless, it's to me disconcerting. again, I think that this is something that probably has always happened throughout time, but the fact that it's happening on such an intense scale, this sort of, what did I say they called it? Quantified nostalgia is, I don't know, it's kind of sad in a way. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's hard for me to think that that having that happen and not getting a lot of likes would actually impact the memory. I know how memory works, and that you do essentially resave it, and you imbue it with lots of different things, and that's how memories morph over the years. But it's just, you know, it's just so weird to think that. I would think that if I didn't get any reaction, I'd be like, well, they don't understand. How awesome that was.
It would be interesting to see person to person how much personality traits feed into this, how much generation feeds into this. You know, are Gen Zers having a different experience than millennials or Gen Yers or not Gen Y, Gen Xers? You guys are considered Gen X, yeah?
Am I?
I'm at the end of Boomer.
You're end of Boomer. Probably
everyone else is Gen X. Bob is
Yeah,
Boomer.
You guys, okay.
Gen
so
X.
Gen and Boomer, Gen you guys are Gen X.
Yeah, I lived half my life in the analog world and half my life in the digital world. So my growing up was analog.
Yeah, and I'm sort of similar in that I'm a millennial, but I'm like on the old end of millennials because I was born in 83. I think millennials start at 80. So like we didn't have the internet when I was a child. We had card catalogs, but I did experience the sort of information age during my lifespan. A lot of kids grew up, this is all that they know. So it'd be really interesting to see if they have a different perspective of this.
Yeah.
And you also add to that, how engaged are you in social media? Like, Jay, I haven't heard anything from you, but you're, I think, the most Facebook among us, right?
Yeah, part of it is because of SGU, and the other part is because of politics.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you know, my Facebook use is a hate-love relationship, and I have very strong opinions about social media.
Yeah, but I don't think any of us, though, are in that generation, like my daughter's generation, where they're just socially online. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, Jay, right. you get into political discussions. That's not what they're doing online. They're just, this is more the, like, just their day-to-day life is enmeshed with their social media in a way that's not, it's not true for any of us.
Right, like they may be getting into political discussions, but they're doing everything else.
They're doing
as
everything
well.
Else, and so so I think it's much more applicable to that generation to think about like their memories, their day to day life, like how cool something is inseparable from how many likes it got on TikTok or whatever, you know?
Totally. Yeah. It inextricably linked. And I think it goes deeper than just memory, although memory is kind of to some extent as deep as it gets when it comes to like neuropsychology. But also it goes, I think it hits to the heart of identity. And this is something I was talking with my supervisor about earlier today. He and I were looking at a study in which individuals had multiple versions of a photo online, and some of those versions were unretouched, some were retouched to make them look better, quote, more attractive, some were retouched to make them look worse, quote, less attractive. And then within a milieu of more attractive versus less attractive other people, they tended to rate themselves in a way that was equal and opposite, right? So if they were looking at a picture that was just their own picture, they might rate it as being uglier when they were surrounded by beautiful people. When they looked at their own picture, they might rate it more like the beautiful picture if they were surrounded by, quote, uglier people. And the problem is that on social media, most images are retouched.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the kids that we're talking about, like your daughters, are using Facetune, and they're using all of this software and filters on the faces. So they're getting a very unrealistic view of what it means to look like in the world. Whereas in my childhood, those images sure affected me negatively as a woman because I was bombarded with them in television, in magazines.
Yeah, awful.
But now kids are bombarded with them by their own friends. Mm-hmm. And this is a
very
different
experience. Yeah, they're taking control of the process, right?
So we're seeing that even self-identity, self-efficacy, how one feels about their place in the world is being impacted in a very deep way by social media.
Yeah, isn't that part of FOMO, like the fear of missing out? Like everyone's having a great time if you look at their online presentation of their life is everything is wonderful. And so that makes everyone else feel diminished by comparison, because we absolutely compare ourselves relative to other things.
Absolutely, we do. And I actually, it's so funny that you mentioned FOMO. I have a patient, I was talking about FOMO with a patient recently, and this patient sent me like a meme from somebody online, and I just was able to access it really quick. And I just love this. I mean, it's a little bit pithy, but whatever. It says, second guessing only prevents you from progressing. Once you've made a decision, fucking live with it and focus on what you're going to do next. Redefine FOMO as focus on moving on and stop worrying about shit that you've already left, like people, plans, and lame ass parties. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no more fear of missing out. Let's focus on moving on.
Agreed.
Hey, sounds good. Kara, I got a question. Yeah.
Yes.
What's this face tune?
I'm looking
right now.
I'm telling you, you get whiter teeth, you get higher cheekbones. It's banana. It's really easy to use, and I think it's dangerous. Yeah.
I'm suddenly 6'2" and 189
pounds.
Can
you add muscles and stuff?
You can add almost everything. You can add definition. makeup.
Kara, wait till the AUG comes, right? Wait till we have augmented reality where we're all walking around with glasses that put a like a good looking filter.
I choose my avatar, right? Here's what I am.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's an episode of Black Mirror to a T, and what Black Mirror often shows us is what happens behind the curtain, right? Mm-hmm. What's so beautiful and dark about Black Mirror is that an episode like that shows the person take the damn goggles off and be horrified by what life actually looks like, that, you know, it's a wasteland.
Used to be called beer goggles at some point in time.
Those still exist.
Same idea.
So, Jay, you're going to give us an update on reusable rockets and a new entry into this market.
Yeah, I thought it would be interesting just to throw some numbers at you first. So space tourism is estimated to be at $651 million, and this was in 2020, last year. So by 2026, that $650 million will turn into over $5 billion. Now, that's it's a massive increase. And space tourism, I don't even know how you could spend money on space tourism yet. And they're saying, you know, by 2026, people will be spending up to $5 billion on it. It's fascinating. Well,
it's the infrastructure they're working on, right? Is that where it is right
now?
For
this decade, it's mostly going to be suborbital flights.
Yeah.
Just going into a suborbital flight, that's the space tourism. But obviously, orbital flights that's what they're going to be transitioning into. But there's got to be some place to go, like when you go into orbit, right?
Now, hold on to your hats, because this next number is going to blow your mind. The global space economy, that's valued in 2019, it was valued at around $423 billion, U.S. dollars.
Whoa.
How many?
$423 billion. Almost half a trillion. That's a profound number. So that being said, you know, how many space companies, you know, companies that can launch rockets into outer space, how many can you name off the top of your head?
SpaceX, Virgin Atlantic, right?
Yeah, going with companies, because that is the future. You know, governments are going to not be able to do what private companies are going to be able to do.
It'll be a hybrid.
It's a hybrid. So have you guys heard of a company called Relativity Space? Because you may not have, you might not
have.
Yeah. And it's not surprising if you haven't heard of them, but they are a profound up and comer. So they're similar to SpaceX, except they don't just use 3D printed parts. Everything they use is 3D printed. So, you know, SpaceX uses 3D printed parts in many different places. You know, I think I've read that they use them in their engines. But this company is 3D printing everything that they use.
Right, so down to the computer chips and everything?
Let's be real, like not items like that. I'm talking about like all of their hardware components. We're not talking about like
the macro scale components.
Yeah, the macro scale components. Not the innards of machinery and things like that. Like, you know, I'm sure that they're going to be buying parts that exist for other things, especially like computers and stuff. Sure, but I'm talking about like the main fuselage of their rockets. You know, all of that, all the engine components, all of that stuff, it's all going to be 3D printed. So on Tuesday, June 8th of this year, Relativity Space announced that they have successfully and recently raised $650 million in private capital. And they'll use these funds to move forward with their plans to build a large 3D printed rocket, or, you know, multiple rockets. Their large launch vehicle is called Terran-R, T-E-R-R-A-N-R. And the newly acquired money that they recently God, we'll, you know, speed this up and make it possible for them to build multiple rockets. Their rocket is about the same size as the SpaceX Falcon 9, but it's actually more like a small version of the Starship as far as functionality goes. But size-wise, you know, it is pretty damn big, and you need to keep this in mind that their vehicle is entirely reusable. Everything is reusable. This includes all the stages and the payload fairing. And if you don't know what that is, a payload fairing is the nose cone that covers and protects the ship's payload, right? So they have these, typically you'll see them like blow away when you're in low orbit. You'll see like the covering to the payload, like just kind of peel off the ship and go back into the Earth's atmosphere. Even those pieces are going to be recovered. The Terranar will be able to lift 20 tons to low Earth orbit. 20 tons. This is impressive. Why, Bob? Because, I hope you know, it's 20% more than what the Falcon 9 booster can do today. That is an enormous payload. The incredible thing is their rocket technology is going to be even less expensive because of, you know, the fact that they're 100% reusable. That's going to drive the price way down. And this might not sound like good news for SpaceX, but you got to keep in mind overall the space industry is in a renaissance. So no company that is sending rockets into outer space should be suffering financially. I mean, it's only going to become bigger and bigger. One of the great things to have in any market, of course, is to have competition because it drives innovation. And in this particular sector, innovation is it. Everything is about innovation here. So Relativity Space is going to have a launch date goal set for 2024. They're launching from Cape Canaveral in Florida, and they recently signed a sizable contract that included multiple launches with a customer that they don't want to name, but it puts them up into kind of in the category with SpaceX, meaning, you know, they're now dealing with massive amounts of money being poured into their company that's going to drive more make the company bigger and drive more innovation and more technological feats. Now, they have a couple of really cool things I want to tell you about. This company was launched only 5 years ago, and they're 3D printing rockets right now. One of the co-founders worked for Blue Origin while the other one worked for SpaceX, and they decided, look, we're going to start a company that's going to go 100% 3D printed and 100% reuse. That was their goal, and that's what they're hitting, and it's happening. They realized that traditional manufacturing rocket components, you know, it takes way too long. There was very little, if any, flexibility once the design has been finalized. And the way around that was to move fully to 3D printing their parts. And they can build something in 30 days that would take multiple years the traditional way. So traditional rocket manufacturing, I'll tell you why. I'll give you a good example right here. So traditional rocket manufacturing used a technology called fixed tooling. And fixed tooling is ubiquitous. I mean, it is the thing that built the modern world. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just older technology now, and it's very slow. This means that they build, you know, specific machines that can manufacture very, very, very singular specific parts. There's no flexibility here. You know, it's like a tool and die, right? They make it. It is used to specifically create this one part. That's it. 3D printing, think of what a 3D printer can do. It's light years ahead of the old, you know, this old tooling way to go. It's just, you know, the speed and flexibility of 3D printing is profound. I would even go, you know, we know how we throw around, it's an order of magnitude more. It's more than an order of magnitude more flexible. Mm. It is flexibility. It's
twice as flexible.
It really is the embodiment of flexibility when it comes to creating products. So they created the largest metal 3D printer in the world. And so not only did
metal 3D printer. I'm just throwing it out.
Yes, and it works, Bob. It works so freaking well.
They've had them for years, they must be so sophisticated now. Damn.
But keep this in mind, that they not only started a new space company 5 years ago, but they created the core technology that they needed to build that company around. And they did it incredibly fast. I mean, 5 years ago.
Yeah, but we have to say, Jay, you know, until they actually are putting rockets into orbit, you know, it's still a little speculative. They have to.
Of course.
Launched anything yet?
No, they haven't made any. They have not formally made any launches yet. You know, they're in the queue. They're doing it. Like they are where SpaceX was about 5 years ago.
Well, wait a second. Dragon 3D prints stuff.
Yeah, I'm not saying that nobody 3D
everybody
prints.
Everybody does.
Yeah,
they call it additive manufacturing.
Yeah, but they're doing it now, and it's been, you know, it's been flight tested.
No, but I'm saying like GE has been 3D printing jet engines for like years.
Yeah, yeah.
This isn't new.
The innovation like here is
it's a matter of how much of it. It's not that exactly. Obviously. It's a matter of what. And, it's also
it's 100% 3D printed and 100% renewable. That's the difference.
Yeah, that's a massive difference.
It would be very difficult, I think, for this company to fail. Like they're testing everything as they go. They're meticulous. If you do a little research on them, you'll take a look at their rockets. Like
it'll be very easy. You just have a few ships blow up, and that's it.
Yeah, hey, that could, yeah. What do you mean? Hey, come on.
I'm just saying. It looks great on paper, but you know, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting.
Of course,
so when they,
of course.
It's very easy. You can't say it's how could they fail. We know how space companies fail. Ship blows up. That's how they fail. They have to actually pull this off.
So you're saying you want them to fail? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying I hope they pull it off. I agree. Yeah, yes. I agree that competition is. This is the whole point of ceding this to the private sector. Partly because NASA wanted to move on to deep space. So we've done the low Earth orbit thing. We'll leave that to private companies now. But the other part justification for that. This will spur competition and innovation and efficiency. And this is what that looks like. We're seeing this happen. But this particular company may not be the one to do it. And their proposals are great, and what they're saying sounds great. We'll see how they actually do, and I wish them well.
Sony right. Betamax was a great product. It was superior to VHS. Look where that wound up.
It wasn't really. It couldn't record long enough. That's why it's lost that.
Well, that's one of the reasons. But
you know, of course,
but the quality was
don't
better.
Don't get me started.
Superior. Right. Now we
Look,
can.
Of course, one more comment, Steve.
All right, go ahead.
Of course, the technology has to work. The point is, it's the fact that there is room for many, many more companies. Like they'll fail not because the market isn't there. They'll fail because they screw up. Which I feel very positive about everything I've heard about them so far and the research that I did. Like, they're being meticulous. You know, they know that these things are going into outer space. It's just great to see the dream. My whole life, one of my dreams was that I get to live in a spacefaring society. Mm-hmm. And we're entering it now. It's happening. More and more companies. You know, I didn't hear about this company a month ago. I didn't even know they existed. And now, you know, I'm fascinated by their technology.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that there is a $400 billion space industry is great, because that means we're there, right? It's been bootstrapped. It's now a profitable industry, theoretically. And it should be self-sustaining going forward. And it's not just suborbital tourist flights. It's going to be orbital. And then also city-to-city. Mm-hmm. City to city transport as well.
Yeah.
This kind of
New York
market
to Sydney. Yep.
Yeah. Anything over 10 hours, they're saying, would probably be cost and time effective.
Practical.
To do a rocket. I cannot wait.
Yeah. I mean, like an 18 hour travel to like New York to Sydney was rough. That's rough.
Yes. Yeah, what would that turn into, Stephen?
An hour.
I'm planning a trip to the Maldives, and mm-hmm. we're looking at it's between 28 and 35 hours.
How many stops, right?
Two. What? Two stops.
Two stops. Yeah.
I mean, that's all travel time included, but still.
That's door to door.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So imagine that you go to where maybe it takes you 2 hours to get to where the rocket's taken off.
Right.
It's a 1 hour
flight. India or something. I go.
And you're there.
It's like,
yeah.
It'd be amazing.
All right. This next article is a bit tricky, I have to say. So this is an article looking at the incidence of untreated mental illness in the perpetrators of mass shootings. And this one stuck out to me because the conclusion seems to be at odds with a lot of research up to this point, which I think probably has to do with the methods that they chose to look at. But let's dive into it a little bit. So what the study did was they looked at a database of mass shootings, operationally defined as shootings. It's four or more people between 1982 and 2012, and three or more between 2013 and 2019 in the United States. But that's not the interesting part about, about the data. So in that database, they came up with 115 people who met those criteria. And of those 115, they wanted to exclude anybody who died. First of all, they only looked at people who were the shooter survived.
Right. And that's pretty glaring.
Yeah. So that
right there.
Every time you have a selection criterion in choosing what sample you're looking at, you're introducing the potential for confounding factors.
Yeah.
So that was one. But I think the bigger one was they excluded any, to get to the 115, they excluded anybody who had an obvious motive for the shooting, like they were committing a crime or it was revenge or whatever.
Right. They said like armed robbery or gang violence.
Yeah. So you end up with just people that it was like a random shooting spree. And
or wait, to be clear, not an obvious motive, because I think some of these people still had a motive, but not a conventional motive.
Yeah, right. They excluded most of them because they had, you know, as I said, a conventional motive for
right. But if their motive was white supremacy or anger towards women or whatever, like no,
those
were excluded them.
Those would not be excluded. That's correct.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So they came down with 35 shooters. The reason for only using ones that survived the shooting was because they wanted to then look at the legal proceedings and use the psychiatric evaluation and all of that information to then determine whether or not the person had a psychiatric illness and whether or not that it was being treated at the time. Mm-hmm. And so what they found was 28 of the 35 cases in which the assailant survived had a psychiatric diagnosis, 18 with schizophrenia, 3 with bipolar 1 disorder, 2 with delusional disorders, persecutory type, 2 with personality disorders, 1 paranoid, 1 borderline, and 2 with substance-related diagnoses without other psychiatric diagnoses, and 1 with post-traumatic stress disorder. 4 had no diagnosis, and in 3, they didn't have enough information to make a determination. So it sounds like, and the press releases and reporting on it so far summarizes that by saying that domestic mass shooters have a huge link with mental illness.
Some
and specifically,
domestic
yeah. some. Thank you. Some. Yeah. Yeah. A very select.
But that there's this correlation group. There. But if you look at prior research, it doesn't show this. It shows that statistically, the association is actually very small. Like for example, one study showed that only 3-5% of violent crimes are perpetrated by somebody with a mental illness. Another one showed that only less than 18% of mass shooters had any correlation with mental illness. So this is coming up with a very different number. Another one was less than 1% of annual gun homicides are related to mental illness. So it's definitely true that, we always point out most people with mental illness aren't violent, and most violent crimes are not committed by the mentally ill. And in fact, people who have mental illness are much more likely to be the victim of a violent crime than a perpetrator of it.
Oh, wow.
And this data has been collected over decades, and it's dramatic. It's like the numbers that I was quoting you there. So why is it that this study seems to be such an outlier? And I think like Karen and I had sort of similar reactions here. There's a lot of qualifiers. Yeah, the methodology is very curious. Now, I understand wanting to select patients for whom there is good data. That's fine. But again, every step of the way, you have to consider what the effect of your selection criteria are. So that, for me, again, the big thing is excluding conventional motivations, right?
Right.
Because then what are you left with? You're almost like saying, we excluded everything that's not caused by mental illness, and right. what was left yeah. was yeah. mental illness. Well,
obviously.
That's not
Shocker.
Literally what they were doing, but that might be functionally, that might be exactly what they did.
Yeah, they were drawing a big Venn diagram around it. And you add to that an order of effects here, right? So we are looking after the fact while somebody is in a forensic setting and hiring, right? The defense or the prosecution, which is a motivated group, is hiring an expert to give somebody who has just committed mass murder a psychiatric evaluation.
Yeah, so it could be completely artifactual.
Completely.
It could be of the legal process. Absolutely.
It could absolutely. Like, and also, I can't imagine sitting down with somebody who has committed mass murder and not finding psychiatric findings. I mean, it's true. You may find somebody who is just textbook on all of these, objective measures, has a clean MMPI, has a super clean cognitive measure. Like, you're doing all of these different tests and you're like, holy crap, this person is very, very neurotypical. But for the most part, you're going to find emotional issues. You're going to find, you're going to find things that stick out when somebody has just murdered other people.
sure. So there's another layer here as well, because again, this is all correlational. Obviously, there's no way you could do a controlled trial to see who commits mass murders. But so it's always going to be observational, which again, that's fine scientific, but you have to understand how observational data works.
Yeah, and what the limits are.
It doesn't directly establish a cause and effect. You have to infer cause and effect by looking at it multiple different ways, and there's always this massive possibility for confounding factors, and the more complicated the situation you're looking at, the more likely that is. For example, and I'm mostly riffing here, but I did look up these studies, 97% of mass shooters are men, right? What does that mean? And obviously, we're not going to say don't give guns to men then, because 97% of mass shooters are men. But
that would help.
I mean, I might say that. But
yeah, well, I'm just saying, like, if you're going to be consistent, if you're saying that the problem is people with mental illness, there's actually a stronger case to make for that the problem is men. But
absolutely,
I'm just saying, if all you're looking at is the numbers, if that's your only criteria.
And it's funny that's ludicrous to a lot of people.
That's true. It does. Yeah. But more important than that, there's a huge correlation between, you know, in the mass shooters with white supremacy, for example. That's actually far more predictive.
And white supremacy, and also negative emotions towards women.
Misogyny.
Misogyny.
Huge correlation to misogyny. And
incels,
loners, you know.
Yeah.
But and here's the other thing. Think about it this way. If you are a lonely 25-year-old guy with schizophrenia and delusions of persecution, and you fall into a rabbit hole of white supremacy and misogyny, you know, that's probably a setup for some kind of a violent manifestation there. So in other words, the mental illness may not be the ultimate cause here. It could just be that those are the people who are attracted to these extremist groups in disproportionate numbers.
It may be implicated, it may not. I think the important thing to remember too, and this is a problem with trying to do this kind of like predictive type of policing or predictive forensics, is that even if we took the most extreme examples, young men between the ages of 16 and 35 who don't have social support, who have undiagnosed mental illness, who have access to high caliber weapons, who, let's say, have misogynistic or white supremacy tendencies, and who have access to radical material online. Even if you looked at all of those, I still think there would be more of them who don't commit violent crime.
Oh yeah, it's still a small number. It's still a tiny percentage of the people that are out there. But they're looking at, this is like what do you call it? Not case control, but they're looking at a cohort here. They're looking at the people who've already committed
who
the crime,
but
and saying what features do they have, rather than looking at people with features and then following them forward, say how many of them are going to go on to commit crimes.
Right. But the problem is we often don't remember that it's a selected group.
Yes.
But then we want to apply things like these people are at elevated risk, or these people are more likely to go on, or these people may become mass shooters. And it's like, no, they're highly likely not to.
Right. But having
like,
said that,
also what we need to remember.
Having said that, I think that we should absolutely have precautions in place so that people who have, that are diagnosable with a mental illness, especially one that's paranoid or delusional, don't get access to semi-automatic weapons.
For sure.
Right?
So
and
it should be part of a screening process.
It already
to get
is.
The...
Let's be clear.
It should be enforced. It should be more enforced. There's too many loopholes, you know, like the gun show loophole and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's just too easy.
It's
too easy.
Even more than trying to protect against people with, first of all, by definition, undiagnosed, untreated mental illness means we don't know that they have it. So right there, that's a problem. But second of all, is it more predictive that these individuals have undiagnosed, untreated mental illness, or is it more predictive that they've been radicalized with white supremacy, with white supremacist and misogynistic material online? I might say, let's not give guns to people who are trolling these 4chan channels. You know, this is where we start to run into massive First and Second Amendment problems.
So they have to turn their phones and their computers over so that it can be checked.
Well, but that's
out.
What I'm saying. People are much more comfortable saying, let's take rights away from the mentally ill, than they are from saying, let's take rights away from people who have, independent thinking and who are capable of making their own decisions. It's very easy for us to turn the quote class of the mentally ill in this country into some sort of incompetent group when, you know, competency hearings, competency assessment is completely different than mental illness assessment. The line in the sand is very different than most people would expect it to be. Mm-hmm. And again, the truth of the matter is that in this random one-off study, they found high levels of things like paranoid delusions, but all the other evidence doesn't point to that. And I fear the kind of runaway, rampant suppression of individual rights that comes out of scapegoating mental illness.
So this is not happening in a political vacuum, because mm-hmm. every time there's a mass shooting, the same conversation happens where the people who are pro-gun rights try to blame it on mental illness. And the people who, you know, want more gun safety say, sure, we need to do better at treating the mentally ill, but that's not the predictive factor here. And in fact, it isn't. If you look like across countries, the rates of mental illness do not in any way correlate with rates of gun violence. It's not the factor from country to country or whatever that is determinative of the rates of gun violence. It's things like access to guns. But the other thing that you could say is, like, sure, we absolutely need to do a better job of identifying and intervening and treating people who are struggling with various kinds of mental illness, especially those that might predispose them. But to not just gun violence, but to other, you know, other situations.
Yeah, I would absolutely think that there would be, you know, other restrictions as well.
Yeah, but if you want to say, like, this is, you know, this is an issue that is really a problem for gun violence, fine. But then you, in order to be consistent and reasonable and fair, then you also need to say, if you have any history of domestic violence, you shouldn't own a gun, because that's actually a far bigger predictor of gun violence, mm-hmm. that you have a history of domestic violence. And so they're kind of almost, if you're going to try to use the mental illness scapegoat for gun mm-hmm. violence, then it is kind of a trap that, you know, logically, because if to be consistent, there's lots of other factors that are bigger predictors.
And other factors that don't even require thought police, like you said. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have to be, how do you respond on this survey about your thoughts and feelings towards women or towards ethnic minorities? It can literally be, have you committed a hate crime?
Yes.
Have you committed domestic violence? Like, there are records. Have you committed a sexually motivated crime?
So, you know, this is an interesting study. It's data. I'm not saying that this is not the individual case they found aren't true, but it does have to be looked at very critically, and it certainly doesn't tell the whole story here. And there's lots of other research to put all of this into perspective.
Yep. But don't rely on any one study.
But boy, oh boy, will it be propagandized.
Yeah, but that's the problem. Yeah. The problem is, it's ripe for exploitation of, like, an oversimplistic presentation without putting it into context. All right, Evan, you're going to finish us up by explaining to us how vaccines are magnetizing us.
Oh, yes. What? Absolutely. Well, we are very attracted to our vaccinations. That is how it's happening. So it's one thing for a person to believe that the COVID vaccination contains magnets, or frankly, metals of any kind, for that matter. But a person may become convinced because, well, for example, they watched videos of people placing a flimsy magnet to their arm at the point where the COVID injection happened, and then a magnet appears to stick to them because of, well, what else? Magnetism. So that's one thing. But it's another thing entirely when doctors get in front of video cameras and they testify before government lawmakers making these exact claims. And worse, frankly. And this actually happened, and it happened just yesterday. Sherry Tenpenny, D.O., Doctor of Osteopathy.
Oh, I feel like she's been doing a lot of this stuff lately.
She is a longtime anti-vaxxer.
Oh, yes. She is familiar.
She has no business going anywhere near a lawmaker. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
She is infamous for being an anti-vaccination advocate. She went on what was described as a rant in front of the State of Ohio Health Committee, their House Health Committee. And she was testifying in favor of their House Bill 248, which would keep a business or the government from requiring vaccinations. She is in favor of that. Here's the money quotes. Hold on to your seats. This is what she said. And I watched it myself. I'm sure you've seen the pictures all over the internet of people who have had these shots and now they're magnetized. They can put a key on their forehead. It sticks. They can put spoons and forks all over them, and they can stick because now we think that there's a metal piece to that. There's been people who, yeah, it gets better. There's been people who have long suspected that there's been some sort of an interface yet to be defined, a yet to be defined interface between what's being injected in these shots and all of the 5G towers.
Ooh, cool. Yeah, what else can we throw in here?
Yeah, you got to get the 5G tower in there because I'm not sure.
And also, I mean, it's infertility.
Pathetic. It's beyond embarrassing. Like, how could she have studied science
right.
for that many years and believe this?
But she's a crank. It's already well established.
Yeah.
A total
how
crank.
Is she keeping her license? That's the thing that bothers me.
That's
the
question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not how can somebody think all these bizarre things. Like, there are a lot of reasons. But how can they also continue to hold legitimate licenses and treat people? That's so dangerous.
So why do you think there are videos, though, and pictures of people who supposedly are sticking magnets to their arms and it just holds there? I mean, this must be a recent phenomenon with the vaccinations, right? No.
Evan, because people are oily.
Yeah. That is,
they're,
yes.
They're sweaty. Yes. So,
I mean, you know, it's not like we haven't known for centuries now that this is one of the oldest sideshow circus gimmicks out there. That people have been sticking metal to their skin forever, practically, for as long as there's been metal, probably, all without the benefit, and for somehow all those years ago, all without the benefit of getting any vaccinations. Do you remember when James Randi went to, was it Eastern Europe or Russia, and tested the famous magnet man?
Right? Oh, yeah, it was awesome.
Spoons and forks and swords and everything else, whatever, would stick to his body. So Randy's there, you know, and the guy presents it, and he does, and all this stuff is sticking to him. Okay. So Randi goes over and takes a little talcum powder, basically, boop, 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 puts it on his skin. Okay. Gee, suddenly, no more magnetism. Wonder why
the
that
talcum
is.
Talcum powder demagnetized him, Evan.
Who knew that talcum powder had that sort of magical property to it? So, you know, again, tricks that have been long since debunked. So let's talk about that first. And then, so she must have also been asleep. Forever to know that the ingredients, frankly, in vaccinations. Did she look at the list of ingredients? I don't know that she did, because none of the COVID-19 vaccinations in the United Kingdom or the United States contain metallic ingredients at all. But apparently, if you put the aluminum, if there is aluminum in these shots and stuff, that becomes something that connects to 5G towers. Now, she didn't, you know, she was very thin on any specifics, like she usually kind of is when it comes to these sorts of things. But I'm assuming, because I had to look it up exactly what the heck she was talking about. There is a bevy of 5G conspiracy theories out there, as we all know. But this one specifically, I believe she's referring to the one that is stating that the aluminum in a vaccine would act as an antenna strong enough to make a person susceptible to 5G radiation. I believe the angle she was going for.
That is brilliant, man.
But and my gosh, we can unpack that forever too. We don't have time. But again, 5G radiation, all this non-ionizing radiation, which we've been over and over and over again, does not impact human cells the way, say, that gamma rays or X-rays do. You know, those are the ionizing radiation.
Or invisible light, which is actually even a higher frequency than 5G.
So,
that
you know,
damn light.
So she basically densely compacted a whole bunch of crap. I called it a word turd into just a few of these words. Yet there's so much there to unpack and so much that you have to debunk and go into explanations for. My gosh. I mean, and you're saying this in front of lawmakers who, you know, frankly, who knows what sort of attention span they have or how deep that they or their staffs are going to go and research these things. Shit, that's when some real damage can be done.
Because
she doesn't have to influence the public. She has to influence lawmakers to think a certain way, and maybe she's doing it.
So the thing is, vaccines are getting us out of a worldwide pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a home run for vaccines. So the anti-vaxxers are panicking, and they're just throwing any shit they can against the wall to try to make it seem like these vaccines don't work, or they're not safe, or they're a conspiracy, or whatever. It's all nonsense. We've been tracking this on Science-Based Medicine. David Gorski's written about it a dozen times. Every time they go up with some new piece of BS, you know, about the COVID vaccines, it's just making crap up. It's all nonsense. But because they just hate the fact that the vaccines are saving us from this pandemic.
Right.
You know? It's not good PR for them.
Nope.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. I can't help but hear, you know that song, Deo.
Deo.
Now, there's layers to that noisy, though. There's the background noise versus the louder sort of noise that's changing in the foreground.
Typically, there's something else going on in the background. You hear people mumbling or whatever, but there is noise in the background for sure. Any guesses, guys?
Well, the background noise to me sounded like the phaser noise from the original Star Trek series. That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, it definitely sounded like the Amazon rainforest to me.
Yeah, I was talking to
is it cicadas, George's Jay?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Cicadas.
Oh, cool.
So I was talking to George Robb. I went and visited George for his 50th birthday.
Yay.
And Bruce Press was down there and he heard the cicadas noisy. And he's like, it sounds exactly like Star Trek phasers. And he played the phaser sound. So he,
on overload.
Heck, I wouldn't be surprised if at the time in the 60s when the sound engineers were working on that, if you know they pulled from a sample of all sorts of noises and for some reason the cicada noise came up and that'd make a good noise we could use.
All right, so I got a guess from Mike Buckley. He said, happy Saturday. I seem to recall that Ian had family in the Carolinas. I don't know how Mike knew that. I didn't know that. And this sounded like a frog or toad calling. So he went to YouTube and he specifically said he thinks it's a pine woods tree frog, Hyla femoralis. That is not correct. However, yes, frogs make noises like that. Go and figure. Another listener named Kendall Bailey wrote in and said, hey, Jay, this week's noisy sounds like the scream of a red fox. Not to be confused with the scream of red fox, which is, I'm coming, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth. Oh, my gosh. That show
is
hilarious.
My first ever guess, and apparently I couldn't resist a dad joke. Kendall, thank you very much, because I laughed two times now at the dad joke. I like it every time I read it. This next one's from a listener named Ben. He says, hi, guys. Ben here, French guy from Kyoto. I think this noise is from an insect, probably cricket-like. It may be played at a slower speed, though, to get the low pitch. Thanks for the amazing show. And then he says, P.S., my 9-year-old daughter totally nailed the popcorn noise 4 or 5 weeks ago, but I was wrong about it. She killed me on that one.
Cool.
9 years old, guessing who's that noisy correctly. Go and figure, right?
Nice.
That means that we're dealing either with dumb adults or a very smart child.
or maybe both.
That's what's great about the Skeptic's Guide, because anybody can listen to it and get something out of it. You know, that's part of the reason why the show, you know, that's why we do it this way, because we want young people and people of, you know, what do you say, Kara? From 14 to 104.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, right? Yeah, anybody can listen to it. All right, so we have a winner from last week named Jeff Jackson, and Jeff wrote, it is a cicada being grabbed and released, and it is screaming when it is being held, ? I do believe that this was a cicada that was under distress and not asking for sex, but apparently it sounds exactly the same. So Ian and his brother-in-law had a cicada kind of cornered, and Ian was recording this for me. Yeah, and you know, it was not happy. You can tell. And it did some, you know, they're weird, man. They are just nasty. The Brood X,
awesome.
Yeah, Brood X.
Yeah, I would never eat them. I'm just saying, it's never going to happen.
Don't say never.
So Ian said apparently the cicadas sing in a chorus to attract females, and they also sing to ward off birds. So he says it's all about sex and death.
It is sex and death.
Yeah. So let me play that noise for you again now that you know what it is, and think Star Trek phasers as well. Ew.
That's an individual cicada?
Yes. It sounds like it's a bunch of them, doesn't it?
It's a sophisticator. That's a dad joke.
That's a dad joke, yeah.
There you go.
I have a new noisy. sliding away from that dad joke. I have a new noisy. This was sent in by a listener named Mark Chialander. Chialander. It's Chealander. Chialander.
Chandelier.
It's probably Keylander.
A little better.
Keyland, oh, like chelation.
Yeah. Oh, see, I actually said I think I'm getting a little better.
I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know.
No, you're right. It's got
to
be.
You really need. You have to.
Mark, let me know. Let me know. Email me. Let me know who was right here. All right. So, what is this? Just tell me what this thing is. Very white noisy, I know, but lots of things are white noisy and are very specific. So tell me what you think this one is. If you've heard something cool this week, or if you think you know the answer to that noisy, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, thanks, Jay. One quick email. This comes from Peter from Birmingham, Alabama, who writes, I just sent an email about the Wow signal, but forgot the YouTube link. Here it is. However, I can't find his previous email. So I just have...
That's amazing.
But he did send a link to a YouTube channel. So it's the Wow signal. You guys know what that is, right?
Yeah, this 1977.
Yep, August 15th, 1977.
Is that the day Elvis died, too?
I don't know.
I got to look that up. Go ahead.
So it was a strong narrowband radio signal that was received at the Ohio State University's Big Ear radio telescope. And astronomer Jerry Ammann, E-H-M-A-N, discovered the anomaly when he was reviewing the data, and he circled it and wrote WOW next to it, which is why it's called the WOW signal.
Awesome.
So it's a 72-second signal, and the YouTube channel just plays the whole thing. It has some information before and after it, but it's just you could hear the whole thing. The 72 seconds was the entire time that the Big Ear radio telescope was focused on that area. So basically, it was the entire time that it was in view, let's say, right?
Right.
It's not like the signal lasted for 72 seconds. It was...
scanned that part of the sky.
It was the whole time that it would have been able to detect it. Now, the reason why the signal is interesting is because we don't know what the source is, and we still don't know 44 years later.
They've ruled out every terrestrial possibility? That seems unlikely.
Well, it's pretty unlikely that it's terrestrial for a number of reasons. So early on, there was this notion that maybe it was a terrestrial signal bouncing off of a satellite. But one thing is it's in a band that is actually protected for astronomical use, and it's illegal to broadcast in that band. So there shouldn't be any Earth noise in that frequency band. And also, it would be very difficult for a signal to have the characteristics that it does, and like for a satellite to be able to bounce that back. Just technically, it doesn't really make sense.
Improbable.
Yeah, so nobody really thinks that anymore. There have been other hypotheses that have been ruled out or abandoned over the years. It's possible it's of natural origin. You know, again, most things that we think are technological or extraterrestrial turn out to be natural. It's always a good hypothesis, and it needs to be ruled out before we conclude otherwise. But you can't rule out that it's of technological origin either. The problem is it was a one-off. We detected it in 1977. Unfortunately, we don't know exactly in the sky where it came from, just because of the nature of the telescope. And it was only picked up by one of the two arms of the telescope. So we weren't able to triangulate exactly where it was coming from. And it's never been picked up again. And the astronomers have looked, you know, they looked in that same basic region of the sky. The same astronomer did over the next few months, never was able to reproduce it. Over the years, other scientists with bigger, better radio telescopes have tried to find it. No one's been able to locate it. We may never know what it was, therefore. So it remains an enigma. But it's essentially, it's a SETI candidate. It hasn't been ruled out as a candidate. So that's why it stays sort of in the public consciousness, and it's interesting. But we just don't know what it is. Unfortunately, you know, there's only so much we can do with a one-off signal like that, you know.
And we don't know what direction we were looking. So that kind of
Well, we know the rough
everything.
Direction. We just can't pinpoint. We can't
like the
really
star
know
or
yeah.
Yeah,
we
but
have
you're off by
basic,
a fraction of a fraction
yeah, right.
of a of
That's
a degree, and it's huge.
That's the problem. You know, the general direction, we can't pinpoint it enough to say it was coming from that star. Look at that star and see if the signal's coming from it. We don't know it with that significance. So, yeah, just maybe one of those forever enduring mysteries that we may never solve. But it's intriguing. It's still intriguing. The thing is, like, if it was repeating, or we were able to find it again, we still wouldn't know what it was. We would probably have to build a bigger radio telescope to detect it with sufficient resolution to find any information that may be in there. In the signal itself, as far with the resolution that we have, we were unable to detect any modulation, right? So there's none of the kind of modulation like in AM or FM radio, like amplitude or frequency modulation, that's where the information is encoded. So we haven't been able to detect any encoded information. Maybe because there isn't any. But to really know, we would want to detect it with super high resolution, and maybe buried down deep in there is some kind of information. We don't know.
One mystery solved, though. Elvis Aaron Presley died on August 16, 1977.
Maybe the wow signal killed him.
It could be. I mean, he was sitting on the toilet and died from a coronary...
They got a pulmonary embolism, right?
Yeah. It says her coronary arrhythmia. Is that the...
I thought it was a pulmonary embolism. You know, a friend of mine who I went to undergraduate school with, who's also a physician, worked trained with the pathologist who did the autopsy on Elvis Presley.
Oh.
So what's that? 1-2 degrees of separation between the pathologist who actually did.
That's something.
Right. Wow. So yes, remember there been for decades after there was the Elvis is Alive thing?
Oh, it's still happening.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's still happening.
How old would he be now? Okay. Let's go on with science fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have 3 news items this week. I predict this one will be fairly easy for you guys, but we'll see.
Oh boy.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just setting you up.
He's setting us. Setting
yeah,
us.
Okay. Here we go. Item number 1. A new study finds that brain age can be accurately predicted to within 4.6 years in healthy individuals based on an overnight EEG. Item number 2. The Chime Radio Telescope has discovered 5,350 FRBs, that's fast radio bursts, including 182 repeaters in its first year of operation, increasing the catalog of FRBs by more than a factor of 10. And item number 3, studying country-level data, researchers find that social media use was one of 4 factors that most predicted spread of COVID-19 in the early days of the pandemic, more so than temperature or humidity. Bob, you go first.
Brain age predicted within 4.6 years. I'm buying that. I think that can be done. The Chime Radio Telescope, 5,300 first year. Oh, man. Damn, man. I'm so pissed because I saw that damn article and I don't think I dove into it. Crap. All right, so the last one here, social media use and the spread. Yeah, I'm buying that too. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think that's too many FRBs, but I mean, that's a total guess. It just seems like a lot. Mainly I'm picking that because the first and the last one makes sense. So, whatever.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so the first one here about the study that finds that brain age can be accurately predicted within 4.6 years. So, I don't know, man. This is the first one. Unless there's key markers that I've never heard about, you know, I'm not pretending to be an expert like Steve and Kara, but
they're pretending.
You know what I'm saying? Like the idea here is like I know that your entire body could look and actually physically be younger. You know, like there isn't like an incredibly firm defining anything. I think it's just like you know you can get an idea, but man, in healthy individuals. Okay, all right, I have to reset this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. We'll wait.
All right, that might be possible. If you know that the person is healthy, then that might be possible. I'm not sure what they're looking at, though. The next one about the Chime Radio Telescope, I have no reason to think that that's incorrect, that they increased their catalog by a factor of 10. I think that one is science. And the last one about the social media use predicting COVID-19, I think that is science. So I'm going to have to go with the first one about the predicting the person's age, a healthy person, by 4.6 years as the fake.
Okay, Kara.
Okay, so yeah, brain age I feel like is kind of a random construct, but I can see that a number would be developed if you just looked at the brains of healthy controls. You could probably algorithmically choose, you know, a brain age based on the number of, or based on the amount of atrophy or something like that. So I could see this being the case, especially if they use some sort of like computer to do it. I don't know. Probably not just an individual person looking at it, but there might be like, I don't know, some way that they could do it. I have no idea about the FRB, so I just have to run off of what Bob said. So thank you for having him go first. And I can't, this one's bizarre to me. Okay, country level data. There's so much in this one. Researchers find that social media use was one of four factors that most predicted the spread of COVID-19. Like as in a binary thing, either they were high users or low users, or they could predict tracking based on their social media.
It was how much they use social media.
Boo. Well, there's probably a correlation. I bet you this is like an intervening variable, but there probably is a correlation between people who use social media a lot and people who are out and about in the world a lot. And if that's the case, then I could see that being science. So I think I have to go with Bob and say that the FRBs is the fiction, even though I don't really know why. I guess that number's too high.
Okay, and Evan.
Well, I guess I'll jump right to the FRBs one. 182 repeaters in this, and 5,350 FRBs, 182 of them repeaters in its first year of operation. Do we get to know what the first year of operation was, or is that, are we allowed to know that?
2018 to 2019, that was the data that they've been able to analyze.
And I'm going to be of the opinion that this one is not accurate. I'm pretty sure that up to that point there were maybe 2,000 known around that time FRBs in total, maybe. And they got up to about 2,000 at that point. So to go to suddenly jump to 5,350 all of a sudden within its first year of operation, I mean, that just seems way too high based on the rate at which. Because remember, I mean, it took them 10 years to get the first 14 or 20 or something. So that increase is just way too steep. So I think that one's fiction.
All right, so you all agree on the third one, so we'll start there. Studying country-level data, researchers find that social media use was one of four factors that most predicted spread of COVID-19 in the early days of the pandemic, more so than temperature or humidity. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Woohoo!
Is science. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is again one of those correlational studies, so it's hard to know exactly what the cause and effect is, but it's interesting that there was a pretty strong correlation. And again, when I say country level data, I mean like if you compare Canada to the US or to Great Britain, right? Not within a country. If you compare like how much social media use is there in Germany and how much did the pandemic spread early on. So there's an interesting speculation about what that correlation might be. There was a bit of a dose response effect, if you will. Like it was not just like the more use did actually increase the correlation with the spread. So one notion is that there was a lot of misinformation being spread on the internet, and that may have been a factor. But another is, Kara, you were close to this, that people who used the internet more were also using it to plan their activism out in the real world. So it did correlate with being active in the world. And so that, which of course would correlate with greater spread. So, but again, it's a correlation. They don't really know for sure exactly what that would be. Interestingly, you know, younger people do use the internet more than older people, so that you might think maybe it's just a that's the factor, but it's not a linear relationship. They found that as the youth population increases, it was associated with a lower number of cases. And hang on, I gotta give you all the information. So with low youth population, spreading was low. So you might think, okay, so that was it. You know, when low youth population predicts both low spread and low internet use, right?
Right. It's just an intervening.
Yeah. But it wasn't a linear relationship. So with an intermediate level of youth population, they had the highest rate of spreading. And then as the population went up from there, then it went down. But so there could be two factors at work here. And one is internet use. And the other is that younger people weren't spreading it as much as older people. And therefore, that gives you this sort of a curve rather than a linear relationship, which is interesting. So in any case, that one is science. Let's go back to number one. A new study finds that brain age can be accurately predicted to within 4.6 years in healthy individuals based on an overnight EEG. Jay, you think what this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks what this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Jay. So yeah, so they were getting the EEG, that's electroencephalogram, brain waves, right? They were getting this from sleep study data, because the EEG is part of a sleep study. And so they would have data from overnight. So they were looking at the brain while it's sleeping, right? So that's sort of a, you know, a critical piece of information there, the fact that it was overnight. It wasn't just getting a static picture of this is the brain activity. It was actually looking at the brain sleep. And sleep absolutely changes as we age. So that might have helped you sort this one out. And they, Kara, you were correct. They used artificial intelligence to evaluate this and do pattern recognition. So this was an AI evaluation of the EEG data. Yeah, and so they were able to, with very high accuracy, pinpoint the age of the person whose EEG they were evaluating to their actual, you know, chronological age.
That's cool. And it's so funny too, because I clearly read it once and then just made up what you were saying in my head, because it clearly said EEG and I like went to fMRI. Because I was like talking about atrophy and stuff.
Yeah, I know you
never
mentioned
find on an EEG.
Yeah, but
you're right. That's an even better indicator is like EEG and sleep. Of course, like
sleep,
your
yeah.
sleep quality goes way down as you age.
Yeah.
But still, they needed an AI to tease that out. It wasn't obvious.
Well, it doesn't say that they needed it, right? It just says that they used it.
They used it to get that accuracy. I doubt they would be able to get that accuracy without an AI evaluation, to be honest with you.
Gotcha.
EEGs are, you know, they could be tricky to read. In any case, although now we're like always using computer analysis to look at EEGs. Like,
yeah, I didn't even think AI. I just figured some sort of pattern recognition.
Yeah. No, it was AI. And Jay, they had to limit it to healthy individuals because a lot of diseases make your brain look older, right? So if you've ever had a stroke, for example, or if you have uncontrolled hypertension, right? And so there's a lot of things that would make your brain look older. And so you have to establish a baseline with healthy brains, right? All right, all this means that the Chime Radio Telescope has discovered 5,350 FRBs, or Furbies as I like to call them, including 182 repeaters in its first year of operation, increasing the catalog of FRBs by more than a factor of 10. Is the fiction. So you know what I did there to make that one the fiction.
Times 10.
Times 10. And they discovered 535 FRBs, 18 of which were repeaters. Yeah. So that was a fourfold increase in what we previously had discovered.
Yeah. They only found the first repeaters, a couple years prior?
Yeah. So before
the
that, there's only been 140, you know? Then this now.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So,
yes,
okay.
There's a lot
so
more.
Then what I was thinking, the Chime was already in operation when it got into the thousands. Okay. So Chime is responsible for.
Yeah. So still, obviously specifically looking for these. So the Chime, anyone want to try to get bonus points for telling me what that stands for?
No.
Okay. Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment. So fast radio bursts are exactly, we've talked about this before. They are fast bursts of radio frequency, electromagnetic radiation. We detect them all over the sky, in our galaxy, outside our galaxy. We're not really sure what causes them. They come in basically two flavors, one-offs and repeaters. One-offs are the most common. I said, like, this one found 535 FRBs, only 18 were repeaters. And the repeaters are also have distinctive characteristics, right? It's not just that they repeat. They also look different in terms of their duration, frequency, and pattern, you know. So there's almost certainly a different cause, like a different astronomical phenomenon that's causing. Maybe at the end of the day, they're similar. Whatever's happening produces the FRB, but they get there in by different mechanisms. One is a one-time event, and the other is obviously a repeating event. And it's kind of like there are different kinds of supernova, right? And like there are some that are caused by a large enough star just getting to the end of its fuel.
Right.
And then there's the ones that are caused by white dwarfs that pack on enough stolen, hydrogen that they undergo a supernova. So there's different types of FRB. So this is great. It's just a mystery that astronomers are trying to solve. I'm sure they'll sort it out eventually. And mm-hmm. the best way to do that is just to find a whole bunch of them, just gather data about them. How are they distributed around the sky? Is there anything? That's the problem. You can predict the repeater ones, but you can't predict the one-off ones. But you'd want to know, is there any other kind of radiation that comes just before or just after them, right?
Yeah, neutrinos.
Yeah. Can we identify what kind of thing? Do they come from in a part of the sky where there might be a black hole or whatever? We have to.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they come from magnetars, but we don't know at this point. Essentially, there's theories about where they're coming from. We don't know the answer. So hopefully, in the lifetime of the SGU, astronomers will figure out what FRBs are, and we'll be able to report on that. I predict we will discover the cause of FRBs before we discover the cause of the WOW signal.
Yeah, right. Or what the hell dark matter is.
Yeah, or what the hell dark matter. We'll say dark matter can go either way. Who knows?
Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Zealous conviction is a dangerous substitute for an open mind. Oh, yes. Elizabeth Loftus.
Ooh.
Oh, mm-hmm. Psychologist.
Yeah, she's awesome. She's
do you know that she was ranked 58th in the Review of General Psychology's list of the 100 most influential psychological researchers of the 20th century?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm not surprised. She's like any psychology student who is listening in class knows her name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And she was the highest ranked woman on the list at 58, which is kind of sad in a way, I suppose.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was the highest ranked woman? Wow.
That's what they're saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, the sad truth of the matter is we know that the state of psychology right now is mm-hmm. that there are more women than men,
yes.
either but practicing clinically or doing research. But that is new.
Yeah, and that's not been through most of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, guys, you know that we have been doing, most Fridays, we've been doing a live stream from 5 to 6:30 Eastern time. I just want to let you know that on Friday, June 18th, which is the one after the show comes out, we're not only going to be doing a live stream, we're going to be actually recording a full episode of the SGU during the live stream. Carol will be joining us, and it'll be a full episode of the SGU. So if you haven't listened to the live streams before, they're a lot of fun. They're more unscripted. This is going to be a little bit different because we'll be doing actually a full show. But we get we get a lot of people join us for that. On the busy weeks, we get, Jay, like 800, almost 1,000 people for those live streams. So
Definitely. More than that.
They're a lot of fun. We do puzzles. We do quizzes. We take questions.
We swear a lot more.
There's more swearing, definitely. You could play the Wolfie game with us. If you don't know what that is, you just got to show up and you'll find out.
I don't even know what the Wolfie game is. It's been long
basically,
since I've been on the stream.
Basically SGU bingo.
Oh, okay.
Wolfie. For the live stream, yeah. But yeah, so check that out for the 18th. It'll be a special one because we're doing an actual show. All right, well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.